Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. Hardly a week goes by without a news report about a new cyber attack on the internet. Large companies, small companies, government, and even individuals can be the victims of such attacks. The science of cybersecurity undertakes to reduce the number of successful attacks through the use of advanced mathematics and computer science techniques. Angela Obraugh holds a master's degree in computer science from James Madison University and a PhD in information technology from George Mason University. She has spent over 20 years working in the computer industry. In Denver, she worked for a colocation company which managed data centers throughout the United States, where she developed secure solutions to protect its customers' data. Angela became a fellow and a chief scientist at Booz Allen Hamilton, where she led several cybersecurity initiatives and advised clients on cybersecurity strategy, management, and technologies. While at Booz Allen Hamilton, she wrote a series of best-selling technical books. She began teaching at the University of Virginia in 2014, where she became the Director of Cyber Security Management and Information Technology Programs in 2016. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Let's start with a little bit about your background. You're a cybersecurity expert. What brought you to that field?
Kind of this progression that actually started, I'd say, all the way back in maybe about 7th or 8th grade. I took a class, a computer class, in 8th grade. The only thing you could do on this old computer at this point in time was write in BASIC code. So we learned how to program in BASIC. We learned how to write a number guessing game between 1 and 10. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. You can do that? And so that originally sparked my interest in computing in general. As I progressed into college, then I took a course on computer networking. So I learned how zeros and ones could be used to communicate from one computer to another computer, even in different buildings. And I thought, wow, you can do that? That's really cool. So I eventually moved my career after undergrad into database programming and then on into the field of networking. Once I was in the field of networking, I started to learn more about security in general. I learned that you could break into computers. I learned that you could manipulate those zeros and ones as they traversed between two computers. And once again, my thought was, wow, you can do that? And so that was what really got me into security. I just started reading as much as I could about it, learning as much as I could. Now, also, this was during the time of about the mid to late 90s. So there were a lot of things happening security-wise at that point. A lot of viruses, a lot of worms. It was starting to hit the main media. And I feel like that's where a lot of people's interest was really sparked during that time.
Did you think that the cybersecurity field was a growing concern, that this was an escalating kind of thing that would keep you busy for many years?
I didn't think it would grow as it has now with over 1 million unfilled jobs globally. I didn't know it would get that big.
Right.
But I did know as long as we had computing, we were going to have the need for cybersecurity experts.
You're also the author of several books. Talk to us about how you got started as an author.
Sure. I really enjoy just trying to share information and educate others. And I was at the time, this was around 2003, I was already teaching on the training circuit on the industry side in cybersecurity. And a few of my colleagues were starting to get into writing and authoring some books. And I thought, you know, that might be something that I would enjoy doing. So I talked with a publisher and I was able to work with them to actually publish my first book, which was about a tool, a security tool called Ethereal at the time. Now it's called Wireshark. By the time it was called Ethereal. And it's a tool that allows you to watch those ones and zeros as they traverse from one computer to the other. So I started out by writing a book telling others, here's how you use this tool. Here's how you can use it to analyze your networks and to keep things secure. And things moved on from that. When all was said and done, I was either co-authored or primary authored on six books.
Talk about your work at the University of Virginia.
The University of Virginia, I'm an assistant professor there, so I teach cybersecurity both at the undergraduate level and at the graduate level. We have a graduate level certificate program. It's a 6-course certificate. And we have an undergraduate certificate and also an undergraduate concentration within our bachelor's degree completion program. So I actually helped create that undergraduate concentration in the bachelor's degree completion program. We just rolled that out this semester, actually, officially, and we've already gotten a lot of interest. I have a lot of new students in that program. So I enjoy teaching both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. Now, I am also the program director for those programs, both cybersecurity and IT. We also have an undergraduate IT certificate and an undergraduate concentration in the bachelor's degree completion program as well.
Now, the internet's been around for 30-plus years, I think. I don't know when it officially began, but it's around 30 years ago. Why has this become such a big problem now? How did we get from where we were to here?
Well, we've had problems all along. We just have more now because more types of devices are on the internet. Back in the old days, we had mainframes on the internet. We didn't have as many users. We still had attacks. You know, Cliff Stoll's Cuckoo's Egg is all about one of the first attacks. It's a really great book. I recommend everyone to read that. That was one of the first books I read when I got interested into security. But now we have everything from our refrigerators to our watches to our tablets and our cell phones all connecting up to the internet. So there are many, many more devices for attackers to attack. There's a lot more low-hanging fruit that makes it a lot easier these days.
Is a part of it that we just built everything so fast? Windows, the internet, our protocols? Or is it just that at the time these things were built, we just didn't think about security the way we do now?
Definitely. Product makers were not thinking about security. That's one of the things that I've been teaching now for over 2 decades, is that we need to be building security in. We need to be building security into the design of our products, the design of our infrastructure. We need to be building security into our coding. And that just was not happening at the beginning at all. Then security kind of became a patch, you know, a Band-Aid that we put on later, an add-on. Now we're finally getting to the point in some areas where security is taken seriously and it is being built in. But sometimes I feel like that whole cycle, anytime there's a new movement in the area, that whole cycle starts all over again. You know, we had mainframes. Once we were able to get security pretty well in place for mainframes, we moved into servers. Then we moved into desktops. Then we moved into things like voice over IP. Now we've moved into all kinds of smart devices. Every time we've moved into one of those new eras, as I call it, I feel like we're almost starting over again.
In other words, you're saying we're making the same mistakes again with the new technology as we made 30 years ago with mainframes.
Exactly. We're not learning from our past.
Is a part of that just the rush to market?
It is exactly rush to market. Yeah. I teach, one of the courses that I teach at the graduate level is securing the Internet of Things. And that is essentially the theme of that course, is that fact that there are so many problems in these smart types of devices is because of the rush to market.
Sure.
It's just not getting built in.
Sure. We're going to introduce a few technical terms as we go through the hour. We're going to try to keep that to a minimum. But one of the ones I wanted to talk about was the word hacker. And the word hacker the meaning of the word hacker has evolved over time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Prior to the beginning of the 80s, a hacker could be a computer programmer or just someone who uses their technology know-how to solve problems and to fix things, or maybe even to create things, as in the case of a computer programmer. Around the early to mid 80s, though, hackers started becoming used in the mainstream media as more of a negative term in terms of security hackers, the bad guys, the intruders, the attackers, and it really just caught on. You know, I still consider myself a hacker. I consider many of my friends a hacker when we use our technology know-how to fix things, but we're certainly not bad guy hackers.
Which brings me to the question, what's the difference between a black hat and a white hat hacker?
So right after the term hacker started being used in the media, and a lot of folks were not so happy about that, those particular pieces of the terminology came out to start distinguishing things. A black hat hacker is the bad guy. basically someone who's trying to break into a computer, steal data, you know, do something they shouldn't be doing. White hats, on the other hand, know all of the same techniques, but they're working for good. So maybe they're working for a security company and they're testing security defenses of a client or their organization that they work for, doing all of the same types of techniques, but on the good side. Now, the white hats are also protecting organizations against the black hats. Then you have that fun little space in the middle, the gray hats, folks that might want to dabble into some of the black arts, the dark arts from the Harry Potter world, but they also try to live on the good side as well.
So in the movies, frequently black hat hackers are converted to white hat hackers for some industrial purpose. Does that really happen?
It can be seen as happening. It depends on the black hat hacker, and it is all kind of gray. Even the black hat, the white hat is all kind of gray. But there are certainly very technically savvy hackers out there who may not work for large corporations or industry that do get recruited for certain types of work.
Right. Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Oba, is here with us talking about cybersecurity and the internet. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Just wanted to spend a couple of minutes kind of setting the stage by talking about some of the more significant attacks that have happened in recent times.
Over the past year, there's been several attacks, but there's three big ones that I'd like to talk about because they cover a lot of different spaces here. The first one was the city of Baltimore. Their computers got taken over by ransomware, software that will lock down the computer. You have to pay to get a key to unlock the data. It took out city services. Luckily, it did not take out critical city services. So we're not talking police, fire, rescue, but we are talking other pretty important city services, paying your water bill, making a real estate transfer. And pretty much any of the city workers with their day-to-day jobs couldn't even get logged in. When ransomware takes over a computer, you can pay to get the key. At this point, the attackers were asking for about $76,000. And the city leaders were actually commended for not paying that. They said, nope, we're not going to pay this. We can fix it ourselves, which they did. But those systems were down for a few weeks.
Right.
So in the end, this attack, I've seen numbers reporting about $18 million is what it has cost the city already, just in lost revenue and lost work, things of that nature.
So actually, they might have been better off to pay the ransom.
They could
is
have.
What you're saying?
They could have been better off just paying the $76,000 right up front and just lessening their downtime. But that's a call that leaders are going to make. You know, the CEO of a company will make that call, whatever they believe is the best interest for their organization. So that was one. Here we're talking about, you know, affecting a city.
And we're going to talk more about ransomware later on in the hour.
Yep, that will be great. The second one I wanted to address is in the healthcare. So now we're talking American Medical Collection Agency. This is a company that works with some more popular companies that you've probably heard of, LabCorp, Quest Diagnostics. Anytime you have blood work done or something like that, that's the companies that are working with that. This particular parent company had an attack where they had about 19 million user records exposed. At this point, now we're talking social security numbers. We're talking other personal data known as PII, personally identifiable information. Because of this, AMCA has actually filed for bankruptcy because of that attack. So while Baltimore is large enough and strong enough, they can withstand this type of an attack, get everything back online. Some other organizations can't withstand. Now, this was not a ransomware attack. This was a different type of an attack, but they can't withstand the fallout. It's a lot of money for something like that when an attack like that happens.
Sure.
So now we're talking city. Now we've talked healthcare. And then the last one was Capital One. Now we're talking financial data. 100 million credit card applications were exposed in this attack. Once again, we've got that PII, that personally identifiable information. So we've got bank account numbers, social security numbers. All of this was exploited and stolen by the attacker from a web application vulnerability. So through the internet, through the web. And this is actually one of the biggest attacks ever. There are attacks that have had larger numbers, some of the older Yahoo attacks, but 100 million credit card applications really puts this into the top. So those are the big three just this year, and the year's not over.
Right, right. So throughout this hour, we're going to talk about botnets, denial of service attacks, phishing attacks, identity theft, ransomware, and the newest playground for hackers, the Internet of Things. Let's start with botnets. What is a botnet?
Right. It's kind of a botnet, ransomware, IoT, oh my. That's kind of how I think with all of these terms. A botnet is a collection of devices that could be anywhere across the world that an attacker essentially owns. Owning meaning they can log in and control that device. So this device might be a web camera in your home. And if I'm an attacker, I can log in and use that web camera whenever I want. Botnets are used to then collectively all work together. We're talking hundreds of thousands of these devices all together in this botnet to do something bad. So one of the big, more recent attacks within the past few years was the Mirai botnet. The Mirai botnet is still loosely happening out on the internet. It was composed of hundreds of thousands of devices, mostly those in people's homes, like webcams, like DVRs. That botnet was used by an attacker to direct a whole bunch of just garbage internet traffic to one organization called Dyn, D-Y-N. That organization was important because it serves the web names for big companies, Amazon, Twitter, Netflix. By going to that parent organization and taking that down, all of those other services were taken down, basically because they flooded that one parent organization with lots of just bogus traffic.
So when you have when you're infected by a botnet, can PCs be affected by botnets as well?
Yes, PCs can definitely
laptops,
take part. Yes,
home computers. What about
anything on the internet can be part of a botnet?
Anything, even smartphones.
Yes.
Right, and I'm assuming that if you are infected by a botnet, you might not know about it.
You may not know.
Probably don't know about it.
You probably don't know. During an attack, you may be, if it's being used to launch a bunch of traffic like that, you may notice some latency on your network. Your device may be unavailable for you because it's too busy doing other things. All of its resources are kind of being used up and taken. But for the general user, unless you're actually using a sniffer program, like I mentioned earlier, Wireshark is an example. That's what they're called, sniffer programs, to watch the traffic. You're not going to know that that's happening.
Right. And that's going to be the case for most people.
Yes. That's
because using a program like Wireshark is not trivial. It doesn't light up and say you have a bot, right? I mean, you have to understand.
You have to understand what you're looking at.
What you're looking at.
Otherwise, right. It looks like garbly gook to most people.
Right.
That's why the Mirai botnet, one of the reasons that the Mirai botnet was so effective is because it was mostly home user devices that no one was paying attention to. And those home user devices are largely insecure.
Do virus checkers find bots in your computer? Are they able to?
Yeah, on your laptop, desktop, systems like that, when you're running an antivirus, they certainly will look for signatures of malicious software that could indicate it has been taken over by an attacker. Right. So it certainly could. That was another reason Mirai was so effective, is by taking over things like web cameras and DVRs and Wi-Fi routers. There's no antivirus running on those.
Right. And even if there were, there's no readouts as a rule. I mean, your DVR is not going to say, I have a bot.
Right. It's not going to send an alert.
It's not going to send an alert. That's right.
That goes back to our rush to market, though.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So I guess the way this would affect a listener the most would be is if their favorite website is getting a denial of service attack. What does that look like from the perspective of the user? Let's say I want to go to Amazon.com and they're under attack. What does that look like to me?
You just wouldn't be able to get to the website. And that's exactly what happened in 2016 when DYN was attacked. Users couldn't get to Amazon. They couldn't get to Twitter. They couldn't get to Netflix. It just gives you a timeout error a lot of times saying website cannot be reached.
Right. So you might even think the problem is at your end.
You might. You, exactly.
You can't be sure. It could be your router or your modem at home or something else could give a similar error.
Very much so. Right. There were probably a lot of users going and rebooting their own home Wi-Fis,
sure.
Wi-Fi routers. Maybe if those Wi-Fi routers happened to be part of that botnet attack at that time, maybe that helped take it off
yeah.
of the line.
Yeah,
sure. But for the most part, users were probably thinking it was something on their end. Now, there are websites that you can Google, is this site down? And there are several websites you can go to and type in a web address, and it will give you information whether they think that right. website is actually down or not.
So that helps you to understand whether it's at
yes.
your end or it's at the other end.
Yes.
Right. Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Obaugh, is here with us this morning talking about cybersecurity and the Internet. You are listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. After the break, more with cybersecurity expert Angela Obaugh. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with Angela Obaugh, and we're talking about cybersecurity and the Internet. We were talking about botnets and the denial of service. I want to talk about now about something else that's become very popular with hackers, black hat hackers, and that those are phishing attacks. First of all, spell phishing.
Phishing, phishing.
And what is the origin of the word as it pertains to computers?
It's essentially just like regular fishing, when you're fishing in the sea for fish and you're hoping to catch something. But in this case, you're using something like an email lure, for example, to try to catch unsuspecting users.
Right.
So attackers will fish for users to fall for the bait and then be able to compromise them or their data in some way. Now, the fact that it's PH instead of an F, that's just part of hacker culture terminology to replace an F with PH. It actually goes back to the old days of phone phreaking, which is phreaking.
Oh, right. Right, sure.
When hackers, not so much black hat hackers, but hackers in general, back in the day used to like to try to play with the phone systems and learn some of the secret codes.
So why are phishing attacks so successful?
Phishing attacks are so successful because the humans are the weakest link.
Right. And
when it comes to all of security, humans always end up being the weakest link. And in fact, it's so much easier for an attacker to just try to exploit a weakness in a human versus spending a lot of time reverse engineering a vulnerability on a mobile device or on a computing software program, for example. Why spend hours upon hours writing code and create an exploit if I can just get it right from you?
Right. And when you get it from the user, you're already behind their firewall and their protection and all that other stuff. So does that make it easier to get at their internal systems?
It exactly makes it easier. Usually what the attackers are looking for is a username and login a lot of times
sure.
when it comes with phishing. So once they have that, sure, they're getting right in, authenticated just like they're the actual user.
Can you give an example of a phishing attack that a regular listener might encounter as they go through their email?
Most of the time, phishing can happen on the phone as well, but a lot of the times it happens over email. You may get one that says, look at these baby pics. That's one of the popular ones. And you think it's from a friend of yours. You're clicking on attachments. These attachments that you're opening actually have malicious software built in. So now that's going to do something on your computer in the background that you don't know is happening. One of the things it might be doing is monitoring your keystrokes. So anything you type at the keyboard, the attacker can now see. So when you do log in to accounts and you use your usernames and passwords, the attacker now has that. So yeah, that's one, having you download an actual attachment. Another one would say something about your account has been locked out from Bank of America, too many unsuccessful login attempts or some reason. Here's the link for you to go fix it. You click on that link to go fix it. It directs you to a website that looks just like Bank of America with a login and everything. You type in your login and your password so that you can log in and fix this. And now that was actually a fake site. And now the attacker has your username and email address to your financial account. One of the things, it used to be very, very easy to detect these types of attacks just by looking at these emails. They had misspellings. They had grammatical errors. There were just a lot of problems with them. But now they're really good. They're getting right. a whole lot better. And they're doing other things to really kind of prey on the human the human thought process, for example, creating a sense of urgency, creating some sort of situation where you feel that you need to react and react fast without spending time thinking about it.
Right. So people sometimes ask, they say, well, how did the attacker know I had an account at Bank of America? But they might not, right?
They may not.
They may just be flooding the market.
Yes.
People's emails with these attacks.
Yes.
The favorite one that I've seen that I've almost succumbed to a couple of times has been, there's a problem with your shipment.
Yes.
Right after I've just ordered something.
Coincidence.
Right. And it's just coincidence, right?
Yes.
Right. So just because you see this and it looks like it's the Bank of America, it doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't know you had it. They might not have known you had an account with the Bank of America at all.
Exactly.
Don't care about the ones they don't get, right?
Right. No, because they're targeting hundreds of thousands of users.
Sure.
So
sure.
All they need is one or two to fall for it. I've gotten those that you're talking about after I have ordered something, and it is just coincidence.
Yeah, sure.
But luckily, I know what to look for.
Sure.
You know, so.
And that's my next question.
I thought it might be.
What can we look for to help protect us from that?
One of the things in these email types of an attack is the from address. Those aren't being disguised as well yet. So instead of it being making something up here like helpdesk@bankofamerica.com, it might be a long string of bunches of characters and numbers at something.bank.america.com, something that's just not exactly right.
Sure.
So a lot of the times the from address, same if you were sending me an email address. So now I think it's coming from someone I know, but when I look at that from email address, it's really not the email address. It's some other kind of obscure email address. So that's one thing to look. Look at that from sender. See if you recognize the from sender. The other thing is, if it is a link in the email saying, log in here, or click this link to check your shipment, for example. If you just take your mouse cursor and you hover over that link, it will pop up and show you what the actual expanded address of the link is. And you want to make sure that that looks legitimate as well. So instead of, you know, I get a lot of these for PayPal, for example. The link might not say paypal.com. It'll say paypal.somethingelse.com.
Yeah, sure.
So it'll have the word PayPal in there.
Yeah.
It's going to try to look legitimate, but it's really not sending you to PayPal.
So if you really wanted to be safe, would it be safer just to open up your browser independently and just go to whatever URL you usually go to, paypal.com or whatever?
Yes.
Is that safe?
Exactly. If I get something, actually any of these, something about an order, something from the bank, I'll open up a completely different browser and log in directly that way and see if I have a message or see if something looks out of place. But you can also call. That's a big one, especially if you're getting this from someone that it looks like you know and it looks suspicious. You need to call them and see if they really sent you this. One of the phishing attacks that's actually happening more recently that's interesting, that's different than the two I just talked about, is someone calling you pretending to be your supervisor, asking you to buy them gift cards and then sending you the gift card number, sending the supervisor the gift card number.
Right.
They'll put the sense of urgency in there, and lots of people are falling for it. Lots of people think, oh my gosh, this is my boss. I have to get these gift cards to him or her because something's going on. And maybe you've bought gift cards for your boss before. Now, those of you who haven't, you think, well, this is odd. My boss is asking me for gift cards. But I'm very surprised at the number of people that actually fall for that.
Wow.
Just call your boss. Do you really need these gift cards? This actually happened at UVA. And no one fell for it. But we saw those emails going around at UVA.
Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Orbaugh, is here with us this morning. We're talking about cybersecurity and the internet. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. All right, identity theft. That's a big one. It costs people a lot of grief. Takes a long time to straighten it out. It's a more personal kind of attack rather than a corporate attack. And what is the attacker's goal? How does the attacker profit from this?
So identity theft is kind of the creme de la creme for an attacker.
Right.
Most of the time, actually 99% of the time, when it comes to attacks in general, they're always out for money in one way, shape, or form. Typically, they're trying to get credit card information, to use the credit cards to get money in other ways. There's actually a process when that happens. But when you're talking identity theft. Now they've got your social security number and other PII, that personally identifiable information that I've mentioned. What that means is the attacker can now open accounts in your name. The attacker can now get credit in your name. The attacker can possibly file your tax returns and get your refund if you're getting a refund. So those are the big ones. Those are really hard, can take years to clean up.
And they don't have to be domestic attackers either, do they? Because many of those things you just described can be done online. So it doesn't matter where you are.
A lot of these are happening in other countries. And then that makes it very difficult to actually track down the attacker or even bring the attacker here to prosecute once the attacker is discovered. So it can be very difficult.
And do we have a chance of protecting ourselves from this? I mean, it sounds like the attackers are getting more and more clever and more clever as each year goes by.
Definitely getting more clever and clever. That's because in the old days, attacking was kind of hobby or to prove a point or to just cause ruckus. Now it's actually a business.
Right.
I mean, organized crime in the cyber world is big, big business.
Right.
So we have to be more vigilant at protecting our social security numbers and the privacy of our data. We have to be more vigilant to not fall for these phishing attacks that we just talked about.
Yeah. And again, it comes down to if you're not sure, you should phone.
Exactly.
You should phone your bank. You should phone your government agency, whatever.
There are many fake IRS scam attacks going around.
Sure. Yeah.
Phone and email. And those are the ones you should never talk to directly. Hang up. Call the IRS separately.
Wow. I wanted to spend a little bit more time on this one because this one seems to be the biggest one. It's in the news. You mentioned it earlier, and that's ransomware. Talk a little bit. Let's start off with what is a ransomware attack? You touched on that briefly, just a little bit more detail.
Right. So it was the city of Baltimore, but many organizations, hospitals, companies, even individuals like yourself or myself, we could all be susceptible to ransomware. And ransomware, to me, is one of those things that's so bad, but I also thought, wow, I can't believe no one thought of this before now.
Right.
Basically, a malicious software program, maybe you clicked on one of those links in your email that you didn't think about. It looked legitimate. Now you have malicious software installed on your computer that you don't know about. That malicious software will take all of the data on your computer and encrypt it so you can't get to it. It essentially puts a big padlock on your computer for you, virtual in the virtual sense,
right,
so that you can't even get to any of your data. It'll pop up a nice bright screen to tell you that this has happened, that your system has been locked down with ransomware, and that in order to unlock it and get access to your data again, you'll need to pay a certain amount of money. Usually this money, they ask for it in Bitcoin. So they actually give you instructions on how to get the Bitcoin and pay. The funny thing about this kind of attack is there's actually tech support. There's tech support to help walk you through the entire process so that you know how to buy Bitcoin and transfer it to the attacker, and then that you know how to get your data unlocked.
Now, you said a few minutes ago that this is big business, and you're not kidding.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
You're talking for a general user like you and I. For our home computer, they may ask for, you know, $300, $400 maybe. My father-in-law actually fell for this. He had this happen.
Right.
And he called me up and said, what do I do? I said, well, what'd you have on the computer? And it was his personal computer. It was a lot of family photos, a lot of personal data for some volunteer organizations that he helps with. And I said, if you want it back, you pay. That's what you do. If you didn't have it backed up, because he didn't have it backed up, he decided not to pay. He didn't want to play that game.
Right.
So he just ended up losing that data. Now, if you're talking a larger organization, like I mentioned, Baltimore City, the amount was about $76,000. Hospitals have been known to pay tens of thousands of dollars to get the data back. So it ranges. But you know what? You can bargain.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can negotiate and try to get that amount down.
Wow. Talk to their tech support, huh?
Right.
are these attacks primarily on PCs and Macs, or do they affect smartphones and other devices as well?
So far, they've largely been hitting PCs. Macs are not immune. There is ransomware for Mac out there, and it's traversing the internet, making its rounds. And smartphones will be next. So they are not immune as well. But right now, it is mostly in the PC space.
And when you say PCs, you're referring to people running the Windows operating
yes.
system. The people running Linux, are they more prone or less prone?
Just the, kind of falls into the same category as Mac. They're not immune. It's just that Mac and Linux, for example, much less market share. Even now, Mac is growing. Lots of people have Macs, sure. but it's still comparatively way more PCs running right. Windows out there. So
it's the low-hanging fruit.
The low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, again,
exactly.
It's just easy. Write one program, services, many different customers, in quotation marks.
It's more bang for your buck.
Yeah, exactly. Are there any estimates at all on the overall size of the ransomware business?
Overall, I've seen numbers thrown around in the billions, for sure. Like I said, this organized cybercrime is big, big money. And so I've seen lots of numbers well over $1 billion market. And that's why one of the questions a lot of people ask me is, well, if I paid these folks, you know, they might not give me that key to unlock my data. Actually, they do. They want to make good on their sale, because if they start not making good on their sale, people aren't going to pay. Now they're losing business. So by making good on their sale, then they know that they've got a, quote, good reputation, and they can continue to make more money this way.
That sounds surprising. Really.
Right.
I guess that's kind of brand recognition in a way.
Yes, it is.
In a kind of backwards kind of way.
And ransomware has gotten so kind of popular on the black hat side that you can purchase ransomware as a service. So if you're not the computer attacker kind of person, but you want to target someone with ransomware, you can go onto the dark web. That's the part of the internet. I kind of refer to it as like the back alley of the internet. And you can purchase it as a service and have someone else do it.
Wow, that's amazing. So we talked about botnets earlier. If you have a bot in your PC at home, can a bot launch a ransomware attack on you?
It could, because the bot is already under the control of an attacker. So mm-hmm. an attacker could turn right around and do that. Typically, that's not the way that it comes through, but it's definitely no reason that that could happen.
So what is the most common way it comes through?
Ransomware is usually clicking on something you shouldn't be clicking on.
I see.
My father-in-law's case, I believe he got an email that looked legitimate about something, and he clicked on it thinking that it was, and that's how he was able to download the malicious software in the background, and he didn't even know that was happening until it popped up the big bright screen and told him.
Right. I guess my last question, well, I have two more questions on ransomware. One is, it sounds like it was really Bitcoin that made this possible, because before Bitcoin, there was no untraceable way to exchange money. Is that true?
It certainly does help. And like I said earlier, when I said, I wonder why no one thought about this before, and that's probably the reason why, is because what are you going to do? Give them your credit card number? I mean, it's a lot easier to trace.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it can be done, though, without Bitcoin, for sure. You can, a lot of the ways that the attackers get to money is through prepaid debit cards and things like that. So the attacker could ask you to purchase these prepaid debit cards and then just give them the number over phone or over email, over their tech support, whatever it may be. That happens a lot as well. You know, when your credit cards are stolen, they're not always, when your credit card numbers are stolen, they're not always used to just take your number and then go out and purchase something. What happens is they take your number, they go out and they purchase these prepaid credit cards. They use the prepaid credit cards then to go into places like, you know, Best Buy or something like that, buy big ticket items, computers, TVs, or whatever. They take the big ticket items, sell them on Craigslist, then they're walking away with cold hard cash in their hands.
Wow, it's like an automatic money laundering system.
Yeah,
almost, really.
It's an entire process. So they could do that same type of thing and still get money from you on ransomware by using the prepaid debit cards and gift cards.
Wow. We have to take a break. After the break, I want to talk a little bit more about Bitcoin, because we kind of went over that kind of quickly, and it might be a new term to some of our listeners. Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Oba, is here talking with us about cybersecurity and the internet. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You can stream us live online at 947wpvc.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. After the break, more with security expert Angela Oba. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with Angela Oba talking about cybersecurity and the internet. We'd mentioned Bitcoin a couple of times in passing, and I just want to spend a little bit more time on that, because it seems that it's had a lot to do, especially with ransomware attacks. Tell us a little bit about Bitcoin. How did it get started? What is it?
Sure. Bitcoin is a digital currency. So you can actually go to certain sites and you can purchase Bitcoin that was originally backed up with real money. But there is, it then becomes all digital. It's all in the digital realm. And that can be used for different things. You know, some companies actually do accept Bitcoin. I heard at one point that I thought you could buy a Tesla with Bitcoin. Not sure if you still can. And so a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin is actually a really good thing. It's protected by cryptography. There's a lot of ledger systems built into it for exchange and transfer. So cryptocurrency is going to open up a whole new world for us eventually in the technology sector. Right now, though, the attackers know that as well. So certainly they're using it to make their job a lot easier when it comes to things like collecting money for ransomware.
So if I needed some Bitcoin, let's say I want to pay off my ransomware attacker, how do I go about converting real money on my credit card, say?
There's many different sites where you can do that, and that's why the attackers will certainly walk you through how to do that, because it is a process, and it changes. The value of Bitcoin is constantly changing. Sometimes it's very high, sometimes it's very low. I believe in the case of the ransomware attack in Baltimore, it was about 13 Bitcoin, and that was $76,000. So it can change like the stock market, for example.
And these sites you refer to, are they reputable, safe sites to, would they just take your money and not give you the Bitcoin?
No, some of them are definitely reputable and safe. Like I said, you can even buy certain products in Bitcoin these days. So some of them are. Now, if you are going to some on what's known as the dark web, for example, they might not be. They might be attacker sites just pretending to sell Bitcoin to you to take your money and run.
And when I buy Bitcoin, I'm sitting at my computer and I buy a Bitcoin, what does it look like? Is it a file or?
It's all encrypted digital. You don't even really see anything. No, you have nothing tangible to look at.
Oh, that's comforting.
That's why I don't own any Bitcoin.
I want to move on to the Internet of Things. We talked a little bit about that earlier. Sometimes it's called IoT. Is this the new frontier for cyber attacks?
It certainly is. That's why when I gave the example earlier when we were talking botnets, it's so easy for those types of devices to become compromised by attackers. They are the low-hanging fruit right now, and it's only going to keep growing. You know, we're hearing about refrigerators coming enabled to be plugged into the internet, for example. There's certainly functionality and efficiencies built into these types of things, but we talked earlier also about the rush to market. When these appliances that historically have never been on the internet and other just types of devices in general that have never been on the internet are all of a sudden on the internet, there's usually no security or very little security built into it.
Right. And what are some examples of IoT devices that a listener might have at home?
So I mentioned before webcams. So a lot of folks might have webcams. Your Ring doorbell, for example, those smart doorbells with the cameras, that's a different type of webcam. So there's several kinds of webcams, even the baby monitor webcams. You know, those have been, those are kind of the banner child of insecurity when it comes to logging into these devices. So all your cameras, your Wi-Fi router at your house itself can be considered that. I have a weather station, a weather monitor on the WeatherBug network at my house that's on the internet. That's a smart device. That can be part of the Internet of Things. Your car may be part of the Internet of Things. Your smart watch may be part of the Internet of Things.
And as you were saying earlier, we might not even know if our refrigerator is infected.
Exactly.
Unless it forgets to remind us to buy milk or something. Right.
Your refrigerator could be being used at that point to probably attack something else and you don't know about it. Now, the good news is your refrigerators and things like that can't be used to mine these bitcoins. They can't be used as crypto miners because they don't have enough processing power.
Right.
These types of sensors that are being built into these appliances and the home types of systems, they're just not sophisticated enough. They don't have enough memory. They don't have enough processing power.
I'd like to move on to infrastructure attacks. We hear about that in the news every once in a while. The hackers in a foreign country are going to take down our power systems or do something bad to our water systems. Is this a real threat?
It is a real threat. And I always used to get asked, what are the things that keep you up at night? And I used to say thunderstorms are my dog. But honestly, this is one that keeps me up at night.
Sure.
Because this is the one that I worry about happening at some point. Our electric grid in general is made up of three main large sections. The older portions of it might not be very intelligent, for example, so they may be more vulnerable to things once all the intelligent pieces do get connected up to the internet. So now you've got a lot of old, archaic, aging equipment all connected up into what's known as the smart grid, the modernized, connected electrical network, for example, all trying to work together, kind of mismatched. And I'm just worried about the vulnerabilities in those types of systems.
And if you think about it for very long, you can really frighten yourself.
Right.
I mean, there's defense systems. I saw a story just last week about the Army or Navy has just upgraded the missile launchers from using 8-inch floppy disks and drives.
I just saw that as well.
From the 1970s. I mean, it doesn't bode well for your confidence that the systems are secure and modern, does it?
If the missile defense, I just saw that as well. And yeah. I thought, what? If the missile defense systems are running on aging technology, what's the electrical grid running on, you know, certain parts of it?
Yeah,
it
sure.
Makes me worried for sure. And there have already been attacks on utilities and these types of infrastructure. Largely, they're insiders, though. There's two specific cases I talk about in the course that I teach, because I teach the course on securing the Internet of Things. And under Internet of Things is also the critical infrastructure piece as well. And one of them was in Australia. There was the public utility that runs the sewage pumps. And there was a contractor who worked for the city. The contractor thought they were going to get hired after the project was done, you know, hired on permanently after the project was done. They weren't. So they took all of this contractor took all of his inside knowledge and was actually driving around to different points in this large water utility infrastructure with wireless equipment outside and logging into these pumping stations, for example. He ended up releasing, I don't know how many tons, I think it was about 7 tons of sewage into parks and into the city.
Oh,
so
wow.
He did cause this attack on the sewage system in the city in Australia. He was caught because just coincidentally, a police officer happened to be driving by in this kind of remote location and saw this car with some funky wireless equipment all set up and stopped and caught him. So that was one. There was another one just over here in the United States on the transportation sector in California. Once again, insider attack. There were some contractors who got laid off or they got fired. I can't remember what. But even though they no longer worked for the transportation organization, they still had login credentials that they were able to get into. So just to really kind of wreak some havoc and prove a point, they changed the timing on one stoplight somewhere in the LA area by like a second or two, and they literally caused gridlock for about 3 solid days.
Yeah, sure.
Just by doing one little thing like that.
Sure.
They were caught. They got some time. Things are happening. We know it can be happening. Right now it is all insider. So I'm hoping we have enough folks focused on monitoring and the watching and the defense side to keep any other types of attacks from happening.
Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Orbaugh, is here, and we are talking about cybersecurity and the Internet. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So is the big one still coming? Google, Facebook, Amazon?
The big attack?
The big attack. That's
the one
coming?
Where I would call the big one something on infrastructure.
Uh-huh.
That's what I think the big one would be.
Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah, if Google, Facebook, Amazon, if they went down even for days, that's a big hit to the economy. But I worry more about the systems that are a big hit to life and safety.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we're just not at a point yet where we can say we're not vulnerable. Is that right?
I don't think we can ever get risk, basically, is what we're talking about.
Right.
We can never get risk down to zero. There's always going to be a certain amount of risk that we have to accept, but we definitely need to minimize it as much as possible.
Right. Wow. So We've talked about all the bad things. Let's talk a little bit about what can be done to save us. One of the things we see in the news from time to time is this thing called multi-factor identification. I guess that's to help block phishing attacks. Talk a little bit about that and how it works.
Multi-factor authentication can help. Might not help in phishing attacks, though, and I'll explain why. What this means is when you log into an account and you're putting in your password, that's a single factor authentication. You're using one type of thing to log in. Now, if you go to log into your account and you put in your password and then it says, okay, I'm sending a code to your cell phone and you need to also type that in, that's two-factor authentication. Now you've got two things that you need to enter in. Sometimes these are also grouped into something you know, something you have, something you are. So something you know could be your password. Something you have could be a code that you need to put in or some other type of physical device you need to use. Something you are could be your biometrics. So you might have to type in a password and still scan your thumbprint or do a retina scan depending on the type of authentication. So there's a lot of things being built in. You can enable multi-factor authentication right now on a number of your devices and applications that you log into. Most banking systems have the ability, if you go into your settings, you can turn that on. So instead of just using your password, they'll also do something where they'll send you a PIN or do a callback or something like that. You can even do it on Facebook. You can enable multi-factor authentication on Facebook. So that certainly will help. However, if I am sent a phishing attack, and I still log in using all the different factors, that attacker can still get in.
Right. We used to always say, don't open attachments. And that seems to have largely fallen on deaf ears. People can't resist opening attachments. So I guess we can't emphasize enough how important it is. Even if it's coming from somebody you think you know, it may still be a problem. Is that right?
I've been in this world for, I think, about 25 years now, and the two biggest things that I've been talking about for over two decades are make strong passwords and don't click on things that you shouldn't be clicking on. Those are the two biggest things I've been saying for over two decades, and it's still happening. Because like I said, the humans are always still going to be the weakest link. And right. I don't want everyone to be paranoid. I don't want to see us move into a future society where everyone's super paranoid. But we definitely just have to be aware.
So it sounds like the only real defense against all of these attacks, both at the business and at the personal level, is sustained and good backups.
Definitely.
Is that right? Is that really your last defense?
In fact, that is one of the the defense for the ransomware that I failed to mention is having a backup. Because if you don't want to pay that money, then you don't have to. You just back up. You restore from your most recent backup. So backup is very, very critical. I actually back up in two different ways. I have a physical hard drive that I back up to, and I also back up to a service provider system as well. That is certainly important, but it really comes down to defense in depth, using multiple layers of security and just being very aware and diligent. So you've got your antivirus running on your computer. You know, that is one way of adding a layer of defense. You've got a long, strong password, not a short password that's complicated to remember. It's better to use a longer password that you can remember.
Like a passphrase.
Exactly, passphrase. That's way better, way more secure than some sort of shorter 8-character complicated password that you may have to write down somewhere.
Right.
So having a strong password, that's a second layer of defense. If you are adding on that multi-factor authentication, now we've got another layer of defense. So it is all about what's called defense in depth, layered defenses, but also just being generally aware. You can have all of the defense in depth that's available technology-wise. And if you click on that link and malware gets installed on your computer that's not being picked up by the antivirus, game over.
I just want to come back to those backups for a second, because not all backups are created equally. So if you back up to your USB drive or some attached drive and you leave it connected to your computer, you're not really backed up, are you?
Right. You're backed up, but it's accessible by the attacker. So it could be wiped. It could be encrypted with the software for the malware for ransomware well. So no, I plug in my physical backup drive that does connect through USB, back everything up, immediately unplug it. It sits there unplugged when I'm not using that.
Right. And of course, if you are attacked by ransomware, don't plug it in until you clear the ransomware.
Exactly.
Right, somehow, right, by reinstalling Windows or whatever whatever method you need to clean that out.
Yes.
Don't bring your backups back to the computer
No.
Until you're sure it's clean.
Exactly. You would need to essentially erase everything on that hard drive of the computer, reinstall it like a default operating system, then you can restore your backup.
Sure, sure. The 2020 census is coming up in the spring, and I understand that a part of the reporting, at least some of the reporting, will be done through the internet. You'll get a little card in the mail with some kind of a code number on it. Everybody in your household will take that code number and separately file a census. Should we be concerned?
This one does concern me a bit. Anything that is on the internet, anything that has a web accessible interface that users are going to go to enter in information is susceptible to an attack. There can be attacks that come from the server side that you're logging into. Maybe that census server has been compromised and you don't know it. There can be attacks that are already existing in your web browser, and when you connect to the census server, that is gathering data. So anytime you are connecting to something and entering in any personally identifiable information, that's a concern to me. Now, this information might not be personally identifiable, but if the attacker already has malicious code on your computer, they can collectively add that to other information they're already collecting on your computer to make it personally identifiable.
Sure. So they used to say always make sure you see that lock when you go to a commerce site and so on. But even that's not for certain now, is it, either?
It's definitely for
SSL or TLS.
Yes, SSL is encryption. And right. So it's definitely certain if I'm going to go to an e-commerce site and buy something, I definitely want to see that lock. I want to know that everything's being encrypted between my computer and that computer where I'm buying something. Now, the only caveat is if the attacker does already have some sort of malicious software on your computer, and I had mentioned before a keystroke logger, that's monitoring all the keys that you type physically onto the keyboard, they can still get data because they're grabbing it before it gets encrypted.
Before it goes to encryption. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. The time has gone so fast, and we didn't even get to all the things that I'd hoped to talk about. This is October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Are you doing anything, you and your teaching are doing anything special for October?
I'm creating as much awareness as I can. This is one of the things that I'm doing specifically in October, is talking with you and all of your listeners. I have another talk scheduled at the end of the month, and I also have some blog posts that I've been putting out there as well.
All right. And if someone wanted to see one of those blog posts, where would they go? What's the URL?
You can actually follow me on Twitter. That would be the best way if you're on Twitter, at Angela Orbaugh, all one word, no spaces. You can also find me on LinkedIn. I post those up there as well. And you can go directly to my website, tomorrow-today.com.
And you might want to spell your last name.
Orbaugh, O-R-E-B-A-U-G-H.
Angela, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been, I was going to say thrilling, but it's been a bit scary as well. But thank you so much. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Sure. Great. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Orbaugh, has been here talking to us about cybersecurity and the internet. This and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when Rick Moore returns to the anchor chair with another interesting guest. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening. This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.